The Honorable Galahad Threepwood had rumbled Sue Brown. His visitor, a theatrical manager called Mason, caught sight of Sue in the garden and recognized her as one of his chorus girls. After Galahad had charged her with the impersonation of Miss Shoemaker, Sue told him that she was in love with his nephew, Ronnie Fish, and had come to Blandings to patch up the quarrel. To her amazement, Galahad was delighted with her explanation.
"It's the finest thing I've ever heard. It restores my faith in the younger generation." "Ho, ho, ho, and a girl like you seriously contemplates marrying a boy like Ronnie." "Oh, well," he said resignedly, seeming to brace himself to make the best of a distasteful state of affairs. "It's your business, I suppose. After all, the great thing is to get you into the family. A girl like you is what this family's been needing for years."
He patted her kindly on the shoulder, and they started to walk towards the house. As they did so, two men came out of it. One was Lord Emsworth, the other was Percy Pilbeam. At the moment when Sue caught sight of him, the proprietor of the Argus Inquiry Agency was prepared for almost anything. One of the few things he was not prepared for was Sue, and at the sight of her, he leaped a clear 3 inches and nearly broke a collar stud.
"Gaw," he said. "I beg your pardon," said Lord Emsworth.
The lightest utterance of a detective with a trained mind is something not to be missed.
"What did you say, my dear fella?"
He, too, perceived Sue, and with a prodigious effort of memory, recalled her name.
"Mr. Pilbeam? Miss Shoemaker," he said. "Galahad, this is Mr. Pilbeam, of the Argus, you remember?"
"Pilbeam? How do you do?"
"Pilbeam?"
said the Hon. Galahad, looking intently at the proprietor of the Argus.
"Were you ever connected with a paper called Society Spice, Mr. Pilbeam?"
The gardens of Blanding Castle seemed to the detective to rock gently. He swallowed painfully.
"Never," he gasped. "Certainly not. No, never." "Fellow of your name used to edit it. Uncommon name, too."
"Relation, perhaps. Distant." "Well, I'm sorry you're not the man," said the Hon. Galahad regretfully. "I've been wanting to meet him. He wrote a very offensive thing about me once. Most offensive thing." Lord Emsworth, who had been according the conversation with rather meagre interest, which he gave to all conversations that did not deal with pigs, created a diversion.
"I wonder," he said, "if you would like to see some photographs."
It seemed to Pilbeam, in his disordered state of mind, strange that anyone would suppose that he was in a frame of mind to enjoy the family album, but he uttered a strangled sound which his host took for acquiescence.
"Of the Empress, I mean, of course. They'll give you some idea of what a magnificent animal she is. They will, stimulate you. I'll go to the library and get them out."
The Hon. Galahad was now his old, affable self again.
"You doing anything after dinner?" he said.
There was some talk, said Sue, of a game of bezique with Mr. Baxter.
"Don't dream of it,"
said the Hon. Galahad vehemently.
"I was thinking that if I hadn't got to go out to dinner, I'd like to read you some of my book. I think you'd appreciate it. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the thing to read. Which is your room?"
"The garden room, I think it's called."
"Oh, yes. Yes, well, I'll bring the manuscript to you before I leave."
He sauntered off. There was a moment's pause. Then Sue turned to Pilbeam. Her chin was tilted. There was a defiance in her eye. "Well," she said.
"What on earth are you doing here?" he asked.
"Well, if you must know, I came here to see Ronnie and try to explain about that night at Mario's." There was a pause.
"What was the name the old man called you?"
"Shoemaker."
"Why did he call you that?"
"Because that's who he thinks I am."
"I don't believe there is such a name.
I never got such a shock in my life as when I met you just now. I thought I was seeing things. Do you mean to say you're here under a false name, pretending to be somebody else?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'm hanged. And as friendly as you please with everybody."
"Yes.
Everybody except me."
"Why should I be friendly with you? You've done your best to ruin my life."
"Hmm?" "Never mind," said Sue impatiently. There was another pause. "That Galahad fellow seems to look on you as a daughter or something."
"We are great friends."
"So I see." "And he's going to give you his book to read?"
"Yes."
A keen, purposeful, Argus inquiry agent sort of look shot into Pilbeam's face.
"Do you want to make some money?"
"No," said Sue.
"What?"
"Well, of course you do. Everybody does."
"Do you know why I'm here?
I've stopped wondering why you're anywhere. You just seem to pop up.
Now listen. You'll admit that if I liked, I could give you away and spoil whatever it is that you're up to in this place."
"Well, but I'm not going to do it, if you will be sensible."
"Sensible?"
"Now listen," he said. "I want your help. I'll tell you why I'm here.
The old boy thinks I've come down to find his pig, but I haven't. I've come to get that book your friend Galahad is writing.
What?
Yeah, I thought you'd be surprised. Yes, that's what I'm after. There's a man living here who's scared stiff that there's going to be a lot of stories about him in that book, and he came to see me at my office yesterday and offered me £100 if I'd get into the house somehow and snitch the manuscript. And you being friendly with the old buster has made everything simple. You think so? Easy. All you have to do is hand it over to me, and there's £50 for you. And if I don't do what you want, I suppose you'll tell them who I really am. That's it. Well, I'm not going to do anything of the kind.
What?
And if you want to tell these people who I am, go ahead and tell them.
I will.
Do. But just bear in mind that the moment you do, I shall tell Mr. Threepwood that it was you who wrote that thing about him in Society Spice. Percy Pilbeam swayed like a sapling in the breeze. He found no words with which to reply. He was still trying to recover from this deadly thrust when the opportunity for speech passed. Millicent had appeared and was walking along the terrace towards them. She wore her customary air of settled gloom. On reaching them, she paused.
"Hello," said Millicent from the depths.
"Hello," said Sue. The library window framed the head and shoulders of Lord Ensworth.
"Pilbeam, my dear fellow, will you come up to the library? I've found the photographs."
Millicent eyed the detectives retreating back with a mournful curiosity.
"Who's he?"
"Man named Pilbeam."
"Pill, I should say, is right. What makes him waddle like that?"
Sue was unable to supply a solution to this problem. Millicent came and stood beside her, and leaning on the stone parapet, gazed disparagingly at the park.
"Ever read Schopenhauer?" she asked after a silence.
"No."
"You should. Great stuff."
She fell into a heavy silence again, her eyes peering into the gathering gloom.
"Schopenhauer says that life's a mixture of suffering and boredom. You've got to have one or the other. His stuff's full of snappy cracks like that. You'd enjoy it. Well, I'm going for a walk. You coming?"
"I don't think I will, thanks."
"Just as you like. Schopenhauer says suicide's absolutely okay. He says Hindus do it instead of going to church."
She moved off a few steps, then returned.
"Oh, look, sorry if I seem loopy," she said. "There's something on my mind. Fact is, I've just got engaged to be married to my cousin, Ronnie."
The trees that stood out against the banking clouds seemed to swim before Sue's eyes. An unseen hand had clutched her by the throat and was crushing the life out of her.
"Ronnie?"
"Yes," said Millicent, rather in the tone of voice which Schopenhauer would have used when announcing the discovery of a caterpillar in his salad. "We fixed it up just now." She wandered away, and Sue clung to the terrace wall. That at least was solid in a world that rocked and crashed.
"I say."
It was Hugo. She was looking at him through a mist, but there was never any mistaking Hugo Carmody.
"I say, did she tell you?"
Sue nodded.
"She's engaged."
Sue nodded.
"She's going to marry Ronnie."
Sue nodded.
"Death, where is thy sting?" said Hugo, and vanished in the direction taken by Millicent.
The firm and dignified note in which Rupert Baxter had expressed his considered opinion of the Earl of Ensworth had been written in the morning room immediately upon the ex-secretary's return to the house and delivered into Beach's charge with hands still stained with garden mould. Only when his urgent task had been performed did he start to go upstairs in quest of the wash and brush up which he so greatly needed. He was mounting the stairs to his bedroom and had reached the first floor when a door opened and his progress was arrested by what, in a lesser woman, would have been a yelp. Proceeding as it did from the lips of Lady Constance Keeble, we must call it an exclamation of surprise.
"Mr. Baxter!"
"May I come in?" he said curtly.
"But Mr. Baxter," said Lady Constance.
He paused for a moment to grit his teeth, then closed the door.
"What have you been doing, Mr. Baxter?"
"Jumping out of the window."
"Jumping out of the window?"
He gave a brief synopsis of the events which had led up to his spirited act. Lady Constance drew in her breath with a remorseful hiss.
"Oh, dear," she said, "how foolish of me. I should have told you."
"I beg your pardon."
"Sir Gregory Parslow said in his notes," she explained, "that this man Pilbeam is acting for him."
"Acting for him?"
"Yes. Apparently Sir Gregory went to see him yesterday and has promised him a large sum of money if he will obtain possession of my brother Galahad's manuscript. This is why he has invited us to dinner tonight, to get Galahad out of the house. So there was no need for you to have troubled."
There was a silence.
"I'm so sorry, Mr. Baxter."
"I see," he said. "Well, it might perhaps have spared me some little inconvenience had you informed me of this earlier, Lady Constance. I have bruised my left chin somewhat severely, and, as you see, made myself rather dirty. Furthermore, the impression my actions have made upon Lord Emsworth is that I am insane."
"Oh, dear."
"He even specified the precise degree of insanity. 'As mad as a coot,' were his words. Well, it cannot be helped. The thing now is to think of some way of recovering lost ground."
"You mean if you could find the Empress?"
"Exactly."
"Oh, Mr. Baxter, if only you could."
"I can." Lady Constance stared at his dark, purposeful, efficient face in dumb admiration. "In any matter of this kind," he said, "the first thing to do is to seek a motive for stealing Lord Emsworth's pig."
"Carmody." "Mr. Carmody?"
"Precisely. He is Lord Emsworth's secretary, and a most inefficient secretary, a secretary who stands hourly in danger of losing his position. He searches wildly about in his mind for means of consolidating himself in Lord Emsworth's regard. Then he has an idea. He thinks to himself that if he removes the pig and conceals it somewhere and then pretends to have found it and restores it to its owner, Lord Emsworth's gratitude will be so intense that all danger of his dismissal will be at an end."
"But Mr. Baxter..."
The ex-secretary raised a compelling hand. "But he would not have undertaken a thing like this single-handed. He would require an accomplice, and I think I know who that accomplice is. Beach."
"Beach?"
The spectacles raked her keenly. "Have you observed Beach closely of late?" She shook her head. She was not a woman who observed butlers closely. "He has something on his mind. He is nervous, guilty, conscience-stricken. I have half a mind to go and question him."
"Oh, Mr. Baxter, would that be wise? He'll give notice."
"Tch," said the efficient Baxter. "There are plenty of other butlers." And with this undeniable truth, he stalked from the room. He hurried down the stairs. He passed through the green baize door that led to the quarters of the Blandings Castle staff, and he was making his way along the dim passage to the pantry, where at this hour Beach might be suspected to be, when its door opened abruptly and a vast form emerged. It was the butler. And from the fact that he was wearing a bowler hat, it was plain that he was seeking the great outdoors. Baxter stopped in mid-stride and remained on one leg, watching. Then, as his quarry disappeared in the direction of the back entrance, he followed quickly. Out in the open, it was almost as dark as it had been in the passage. That grey, threatening sky had turned black by now. It was a swollen mass of inky clouds, heavy with thunder. But it took more than dirty weather to quell the efficient Baxter when duty called. Like the character in Tennyson's poem who followed the gleam, he followed the butler. There was but one point about Beach which even remotely resembled a gleam, but it happened to be the only one which at this moment really mattered. He was easy to follow. The shrubbery swallowed the butler. A few seconds later, it had swallowed the efficient Baxter.